Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Friendly Critics, where we dive deep into the world of movies and TV shows, dissecting them with a critical eye while maintaining a friendly and approachable tone. Join us as we explore the intricacies of storytelling, character development, and cinematic techniques, all with a dash of wit and insight. Whether you're a cinephile or just love a good binge watch, this is the podcast for you. Again, I just want to welcome everyone. I'm Benjamin Rollins, and this is Adam Manchester. We uploaded our first episode a few weeks ago, where we looked at Andor Season 1. That was our first episode. The discussion we had was apparently so impressive that afterwards, Adam was crying, just tears of joy afterwards. It was such a cathartic experience for him. To talk about Andor. He's tearing up right now.
Full on weeping. Yeah. And you know what? I've never been the same since.
He's actually wearing the same shirt, still, and that is still tear stained as well.
Didn't change a thing.
This week we're going to be looking at the Fellowship of the Ring. So that is the first of not only the book trilogy by J.R. Tolkien, but also the first in the movie trilogy by Peter Jackson. For reference, as we're talking about it, I'll speak for myself. I watched the extended edition of Fellowship of the Ring, and so I may mention scenes or parts that maybe you as the audience or perhaps Adam is unfamiliar with, but just to give you and those who are listening a heads up, I will be referencing the extended edition. To kind of begin, before I even talk about the movie, I just want to comment on, to me, Lord of the Rings overall. My love for the movies exceeds that of the books, in that I've read the first book, Fellowship of the Ring, and I made it about halfway through the Two Towers, and then I stopped. I couldn't really get past the second half, nor did I even attempt Return of the King. And, you know, I may go back to it at some point, but one, I'm not the biggest fantasy fan when it comes to literature. With movies, it's a little bit more nuanced, though unfortunately there's just not a lot of very compelling fantasy movies. They often are kind of appeal to least common denominator tropes within fantasy, where you have a main character who's young and there's a prophecy that he'll conquer some dark force and there's a mentor figure. And so I found that they often adhere very, very closely with the hero's journey, and it just comes across as, I don't want to say uninspired, but it doesn't really elicit any kind of positive emotion for me, particularly to see it over other genres like science fiction or even just drama and action and adventure. But with Lord of the Rings, though the books have been a challenge for me, the movies themselves hold such a special place for me. In fact, I was telling Adam this a few days ago, that after I watched Fellowship of the Ring, and technically I watched it over 2 days because the extended edition for Fellowship is almost 4 hours. And after I finished basically the second half, I immediately started Two Towers. I was like, I can't stop here. I have to watch the next movie. And, you know, there's just something about the genre of Lord of the Rings. No, excuse me, not the genre. There's something about the way Lord of the Rings engages with the fantasy genre, particularly the movie version done by Peter Jackson. And in particular, just to kind of open with a kind of a question to Adam, is what do you think it is about the movie version of Lord of the Rings, and we can even say specific to Fellowship of the Ring, what is it that has enabled it to maybe rise above so many other adequate to mediocre fantasy entries, both before and since? And also, not just movies, but television.
Oh, goodness. I guess if I had to, like, boil it down kind of just condense that all of that into like a single kind of opinion statement. I would probably say it is, I think that certain actors and their portrayal of the characters bring to life some of the prose there, some of the written word. And it's just like whenever I hear Ian McKellen speak, it's just captivating. And it's, it's no different than a lot of other fantasy things. So they're talking about events. They're talking about historical happenings. They're talking about characters, people, things. And, any other, work, any other work or book, you might just be like, okay, it is what it is. This is it. Lord of the Rings, it just sucks you in. It's just like, I'm just like, I find myself just hanging on every word of these movies. It's because it's just so, it feels so weighty.
Yes.
It feels so important in a good way. It forces me to listen almost as if Peter Jackson is the one wielding the ring and bending me to his will.
Very, very good.
because, or I guess Tolkien in this case, it's an adaptation, whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's it. I mean, I've started the first book. I'm just going to go ahead and establish my history here with Lord of the Rings, which is not very deep. I am by far not an expert in this trilogy or the whole mythos around this. I've watched the movies, I've watched the Hobbit movies, and I've watched that Amazon series,
Ring of Power,
recent one, Ring of Power. I've done some reading and some YouTube videos here and there because the lore is interesting, but I almost think it gets a little too deep here in places.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's almost too much to consume in a short time. But I don't know. I think ultimately, yeah, I think just the, I just, and I guess the execution is just so well done.
Yeah.
That it just leaves me hanging on to everything that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it. It is enrapturing, and as I was watching Fellowship of the Ring in particular, there's a scene in right before Frodo begins his journey when Gandalf figures out that this is the One Ring made by Sauron, and Frodo agrees to begin his journey. He doesn't necessarily know that it's going to take him to Mount Doom. At that point, his focus is on making it to meet up with Gandalf in the city of Bree, and then we learn later basically to give it to the elves in Rivendell. But in that scene, and right before Frodo goes off on his journey, they hear a rustling outside, and it's Sam who's in the bushes. And so Gandalf yanks him in and, what did you hear? And Sam's basically saying, I want to go on this journey. And in particular, to me, the hobbits, so Sam, Frodo, Merry, and Pippin, in particular, those four, that, interestingly enough, before any of them go on the journey, there's no real hook for any of their characters in a sense of not necessarily finding them interesting, but just in getting a sense of who they are as a person within this world. For Frodo, we know that he is living in Bilbo's house in Far End, and has some questions about Bilbo's strange behavior. For Sam, he just likes Rosie and he's a nice guy. And then Merry and Pippin are just basically twins who are mischievous. And at the same time, though they're so simply introduced, their bond and their on-screen chemistry and the fact that for characters like the hobbits that are the central players who are moving the plot forward, Because really, I would argue that what happens outside of Frodo and Sam, once they begin their journey as a duo, all of that stuff that happens outside of them is really not, it's not even really a parallel plot. I think it is supporting what Frodo and Sam are doing. Not necessarily always a mirror, but I don't necessarily think there are two plots running parallel where you have, you know, Aragorn and Gandalf and Gimli and Legolas, perhaps, and then you have the Hobbits or Merry and Pippin. Then on the other side of that, I don't really think there are parallel plots. I think it's Frodo and Sam, and particularly by the end of the Fellowship of the Ring. And it's just fascinating to me that they're introduced, as I said, so simply, but yet like you were saying, you find yourself captivated by what they're doing. And to me, it's because the opening scene of the movie, and interesting enough, I was listening to a commentary where one of the struggles they had with that opening scene, which is depicting the great battle between elves and men and Sauron, was they said every time we wrote that scene, it was so much exposition. It felt like we were just dumping mountains of information on the audience. And they said, this can't be the case. So what they did was, the writers and Peter Jackson said, we're going to simplify it as much as possible. And the exposition, what we're going to do is we're going to weave in throughout the movie, introducing what portions are important. But the beginning, we just need to establish a basic. There was a Dark Lord. He almost won. He didn't. But due to human error, there's a chance he will succeed again. And to me, it's one, how they set it up. And two, there's just something so... there's just something so mesmerizing about what it is they have to do that it almost completely compensates for the fact that for Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin, when they're introduced and once they begin their journey, they almost feel like static characters. We know Frodo won't be because he has the ring, but it's just interesting that I've never seen... I can't really recall a movie where you had the main characters set up in such a static manner, and yet it didn't necessarily matter to me because there was something about the inciting incident, there was something about the journey itself that compensated for that, even though it's a simple story of good versus evil.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that because... two things I want to address here. One, let's go back to exposition real quick. And
yeah.
I noticed that this on this viewing, I realized that there's a lot of it throughout the entire movie.
Yep.
I was like, oh yeah, like there's a lot of history lessons that they kind of allude to.
Yes.
But that being said, I do think that they did a great job of weaving it in, having it be clear, complete, but not overbearing.
Yes.
Like it feels natural. It feels comfortable. And it's just as well done as the modern quote unquote modern day of the story itself, because I feel like they could have easily, you know, glossed over it or like not invested as much into like the cinematography of those kind of flashbacks or even like the writing when they do say like, oh yeah, this and this thing happened and this is this person, because sometimes it really is like you see the past and it's shot on film. Yep. And sometimes it's just Legolas talking about something and they could have skimped on that. They could have, yeah. I mean, they could have done it horribly. It could have been overbearing, or they could have skimped and just glossed over it. And it still feels weird. It just feels natural though.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's a big victory of the people who made this movie, is that they were able to do this. And it sounds like they took it seriously from what you said about, you know, writing it down, thinking about it, trying to reshoot it. I think they succeeded. I think they include everything they need to include, because I mean, I get it. There's a huge story before the story begins.
Oh, yeah.
So I think they did a great job of of weaving that in. And it's interesting that you say about our Hobbit heroes being somewhat static characters, and I'd argue they change in some ways. Definitely by the end of the third movie, I think they're all traumatized in one form or fashion.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting because I just thought that, in a sense, them kind of being static, I think, kind of stems from the Shire kind of being this ethereal, unchanging place. I mean, it's almost like heaven-esque in a way. I mean, it's kind of bright, when they do the shots there, unless it's nighttime. But I mean, yeah, you kind of get the vibe that this is kind of this, very nature-y, beautiful, tucked away place.
Yes.
And the people are who they are. They spend the whole, the extended version, I think this is exclusive to it, but they spend the whole chunk of time in the beginning talking about hobbits and how they're like carefree and they're just relaxed and they enjoy the simple pleasures in life and they don't care much for big business or anything that happens outside the Shire. They're just living life. And so I think it's interesting because I think that carries over into the characters, Merry and Pippin and Sam and Frodo. And so it's interesting to see, because I think, there's the potential for unchanging protagonists to be boring. Not that I think they're totally unchanging, but I kind of get that they are probably go through less of an arc perhaps than some of the other characters do personally. But I think kind of the clash and the interesting part comes there is not how they change when they go to these new places, but how they stay consistent through those new place, through these new places and these new people they meet, and how their kind of unchanging natures interact with the people they come into contact with and the places they go. So I think, part of it is that it's part of where they're from and who they are. Part of it is, it works because it allows you for them to be consistent. The ring is wearing them down. All these other people might be trying to wear them down. They're trying to stay consistent because their goal is to get to Mount Doom eventually. Yeah. and it's tough and it's hard and it's tempting them. And wearing on them, but the interesting part of that is that their battle is trying to preserve who they are in a way without losing themselves.
Absolutely. No, that's a great point about the Shire operating as sort of a heaven-esque, as you said, place where, as the intro does, particularly in the extended edition, the hobbits, they just eat and smoke tobacco. That is essentially the function of their life in a lot of ways. They're, I don't want to say simple-minded, but they are very singularly minded in that the day-to-day, the
they
end
like
goal.
Simple lives.
Yes.
Yeah, they like simple lives. It is an uncomplicated region of the world. It's beautiful, and they find beauty in the simple things.
Yes. Yeah. And interestingly enough, one thing in particular with the hobbits and with the Shire is that, well, one, we learn that Gollum or Sméagol is a hobbit who was corrupted by the ring and thus turned into the sort of deformed creature that we actually see. Though there is a flashback in Return of the King to Sméagol, or excuse me, Gollum before the transformation. And to me, it's the Shire and the Hobbits strike me as a stand-in and as a substitution for this idea of a prophecy that someone will defeat evil or darkness. And one, I find that very refreshing, that nowhere really in Lord of the Rings is there some kind of proclamation that a small man with a partner slash friend slash confidant are going to embark on this quest and defeat Sauron. There's no There's no rumor of the hobbits really going about this in any sort of way. And even the talk of Aragorn assuming the mantle of king as Isildur's heir, Isildur being the one who cut off Sauron's fingers and separating him from his ring, that's not even really a prophecy. He is literally Isildur's heir, and he just doesn't really want to be king. But there's no prophecy that, in any way, it's just talked about that Aragorn's out there, and he's now kind of getting back into the, I don't want to say the fray, but he's getting back into the substance of Middle-earth instead of just operating on the fringes. And so people are talking about it as they would in any area where you have someone who's basically post-royalty. And so to take the idea of a prophecy, well, Star Wars does this, right? The prophecy of the chosen one, right? Mm-hmm. They eliminate that entirely. And basically, they thrust a almost a prophecy-level task on those characters who are, as you were saying, the most unchanging. And it just is very eye-opening and engaging to me and compelling that you take the idea of the hero's journey, and instead of the inciting incident being something along the lines of they learn that within their family, within their heritage, within their bloodline, there's this power, there's this ability, there's this call, that the inciting incident or the call to action is basically an accident. Instead of an inciting incident, it's an accidental incident where Bilbo comes across the ring, gives it to Frodo, and the movie talks about it as fate, and I'm aware they kind of mention that Frodo was meant to get the ring. But in some ways, yes, the characters believe that, but not to the extent where it comes across as a kind of a prophecy, more just it's good. It's probably the best thing that you ended up with this, Frodo, because you're able to carry on this challenge. And it almost reminds me of the movie Arrival, where at the beginning you have a character, Amy Adams' character, and basically by the end of the movie you learn that with the language she learns, she realizes that if she has a daughter, that daughter is going to die, and she does it anyway. And in this movie, you almost have characters who, like you were saying, are unchanging and constant, and they know that this will change them in some way, but yet they go through it anyway. And the way it's crafted in the movie and the way they put it together is something that just stands out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, gosh, it's just such a this trilogy is just such so good. It holds up so well.
Oh yeah.
Because I was trying to think, like, when were these filmed? And I was just like, okay, yeah, so like early thousands, mid 2000s.
Yeah.
It was just like, and it doesn't look like, other than the actors obviously having aged since then. I'm looking at this, and I'm just like, this still looks great.
Yep.
It just holds up so well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think it's well performed by everybody too. I, you know, throughout this, and even from it's been a while since I've seen Two Towers and Return of the King, but you know, I haven't yet encountered anyone who seems like they're phoning it in.
Yeah.
Like everyone seems like they're invested in the role at least, or at the very least acting very well, you know, even if they don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's such just a professional job. You know, everyone's at the very least appears to be like present and engaged, and it's just so well done. Like I could almost believe that these characters these actors are the characters almost. Like,
yeah,
it's just so well done. One interesting thing that I caught this time around was how the ring interacts with the world. So when Bilbo kind of reluctantly drops it on the ground at his home, you know, it doesn't bounce. You know, you drop a real ring in real life, it might bounce some. It's probably going to twirl around a lot. It'll make a lot of noise. This ring, it just does one little thump and like hits the ground.
Yep.
So it lends some like weight to the ring, and I guess its pull on whoever it is around in its attempt to get back to its master.
Yep.
So that's another interesting thing I thought is found as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about Saruman and Gandalf.
Absolutely, yeah.
Obviously, you know, they're both wizards.
Yes.
They both look relatively similar. You know, they've got the what you stereotypically think of a wizard outfit, you know, long beards, robes, sometimes
pointy hat.
Exactly. I'm like, okay. So let's talk about how wildly different these two end up. Because, I mean, they're a foil of each other, I think, a lot of times.
Yes.
So I guess let's talk about the trajectories of these two characters and how you have one who is ultimately like either unfazed by the pull of darkness, or at the very least able to withstand it, or at least recognize not to get himself into situations where he can be influenced by that. And another one who, you know, supposedly even outranks Gandalf, who ends up betraying, you know, the world essentially. And, the Council of Elrond, I think, and everyone who's trying to fight back against Sauron. So that's a big flip right there.
Yes.
So I guess let's talk a little bit. I want to hear your thoughts about kind of the trajectories of these two and how that comes about.
For Gandalf in particular, when he's introduced, he's coming into the Shire with a wagon, and it very much comes across almost like a sort of grandfather type figure, where he knows the hobbits well. He knows Bilbo very well because of their journey prior to Lord of the Rings in The Hobbit. And there's a scene where that abruptly shifts, which is when Bilbo is reluctant to give up the ring. And he assumes this very menacing, he kind of stands at his full stature. He dismisses the previously seen frail frame that he had. And Bilbo cowers and, you know, says, "I'm sorry." And, you know, eventually, as you said, he drops the ring with the thud. And then throughout the Fellowship, particularly in the extended edition, you see that Gandalf is he's a traveler and a nomad. He kind of goes from region to region. He knows a lot of people. He essentially remembers everything almost. And yet to me, his morality, what I think is interesting, if for his trajectory, he's never established to me as sort of a moral paragon. His choices are all responses to the challenge of the ring, in the sense that I don't really necessarily think his choices are, this is going to sound strange, but I don't think his choices are his own, while at the same time Saruman's choices are his own. And so let me explain briefly. For Gandalf, his decisions to me don't come from an upspringing or an upwelling of his own morality, but more so a sort of deterministic functioning of his role within Middle-earth. Whereas for Saruman, he did have a role, which was to be the head of the Wizard Order in Isengard. And yet, he chose to go against that and align himself with Sauron in an attempt to take over Middle Earth and subjugate it all under both of them as sort of co-rulers. And yet, for Saruman, I argue his decisions come from free will, whereas Gandalf's come from a more deterministic point of view. And I don't necessarily know if this was intentional by Tolkien or something that sort of sprung accidentally in trying to have them be foils of each other. But it's, to me, it's another interesting caveat that a lot of stories don't do, where you have two characters that are opposite of each other, but whose nature is that opposed. Usually you'll have two characters who one is moral, one is immoral. One is courageous and the other is cowardly. One is steadfast and the other is fickle and cavalier. But yet with this one, it goes more than just personality traits and almost goes down to their purpose. And I find their trajectories fascinating because they're very prescribed. And yet for both of them, it comes across almost the opposite. Whereas for Gandalf, it seems that he is, like I said, this grandfatherly noble man who resists the temptation of the ring and who does what he must and sacrifices himself for the fellowship against the Balrog. And then for Saruman, you think it's the opposite, in a sense, that he is sort of almost the stereotypical villain, right? The one who you can trust who is not actually the one you can trust. And so really his purpose all along was to try to align himself with Sauron. And I think that decision, whether it was deliberate or not, is really fascinating in that the character on the surface, I would argue, is not actually who they are.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's interesting you say, like, you know, adhering to their purpose or giving them a purpose, because my understanding is that all of the wizards are essentially like angelic beings, but yep, sent to Middle Earth in the form of a wizard. Yes. I think there's five, I think, that eventually made it. And I think it said that, you know, only one stayed true to their purpose, which was technically Gandalf.
Yes.
And I've seen a lot of people argue that maybe Radagast, you know, because,
right,
you know, because the person who sent him was like over kind of nature. And so that maybe he fulfilled his purpose by just kind of protecting nature. So there's a lot of arguments about that, but I won't get into that. But it's interesting, though, that, yeah, perhaps Gandalf is more sticking to his purpose and making decisions maybe based off of that, or maybe not even decisions. It's just his decisions could just be reactions to his purpose and things that affect it. It's also interesting that you said about power sharing between Sauron and Saruman, the homies with two names that sound way too similar.
Yeah, they do. Agree, yes.
Can you make it any more obvious that this wizard's going to be evil?
Yes, I know.
But because, I mean, I don't think Saruman's a fool. I mean, others might argue that, but I don't think he's not a foolish being.
No.
And Gandalf even tells him Sauron does not share power.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder, what is Saruman's aim here? Is he just blinded by the desire for power and domination that he's just willing to overlook that fact? Or maybe he thinks that, like, okay, I'll become so powerful, I'll raise up my own army, I'll use my own powers, and I'll be able to challenge Sauron and beat him.
Yeah.
Or is there something else at play here? Because given the fact that Gandalf tells him this information and the fact that he's not a fool himself, What's driving him at this point? Because obviously he has to know the truth in the situation, which Sauron, once he's done using Saruman, is going to betray him.
Yes.
Or at the very least, try to keep him on a much lower peg than what Saruman wants to be.
Oh, for sure.
So what's Saruman's drive here, do you think?
Yeah, very, very good question. To me, I would say his drive is, to me, it strikes as the manifestation of full corruption, where even by the start of Lord of the Fellowship of the Ring, the assumption is that Saruman has already turned. Because when Gandalf goes to him and says that they have the ring, that's when he traps him on top of the Tower of Isengard. So the assumption is that before the even movie starts, potentially, that Saruman has already aligned himself with Sauron and is waiting for their plan, or at least his part of the plan, to move forward. And so what I mean, that's sort of the full state, or the sort of optimal state of corruption, where for Saruman, I think he knows that Sauron will not share power, and that he doesn't address when Gandalf says that, and he also doesn't appear fazed by it, which strikes me as something that he has considered that before. And being that he is exceedingly old, like Gandalf, he would know what Sauron was like.
Sure.
He would have an actual memory of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but at the same time, I also don't think his drive is that he would try to usurp Sauron either. I truly believe he felt in his peak corruption, I think he thought that Sauron's end goal was what was best for Middle Earth, in that if he had to eventually decrease so that Sauron could increase, I believe that's something he would have gone. I believe that's something he would have gone along with. Now, I know in the Fellowship, I believe, or maybe in the Two Towers, he says something where he uses some wording that implies that there would be some kind of partnership, like perhaps it's words like we or are. But I've always viewed that through him realizing he will be subservient. And so I think ultimately his drive is as... I will actually go back and say it's almost next level corruption, where he is so depraved that he is willing to reduce himself in order that something like this could take place. And, you know, at its heart, of course, you know, the novel is a classic story of good versus evil. And to me, right, Sauron is just your typical Dark Lord character who wants to subjugate the world and just wants power, right? I mean, Tolkien didn't like allegories, but he's essentially Lucifer. Or I guess technically you say Morgoth is Lucifer.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Sauron is sort of a disciple of that. And so to me, I would say that Saruman at that point is then... I mean, I don't know necessarily a title for that, but showing to me that Sauron is evil, but I would argue that Saruman is more evil, because he's willing to let evil take him beyond even what Sauron has done. Because at least Sauron is selfish. Whereas Saruman, to me, strikes as almost, if I were going to say it, almost a kind of chaotic evil, mm-hmm. whereas Sauron is more of a planned evil.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I do think they are very different, mm-hmm. even though they're on the same side.
What's your take?
On that question, or just on Sauron in general?
Yeah, on Saruman, yeah, on the question you had posed.
Sure. I can kind of see it both ways. I could see a quote-unquote simpler answer, being that he is just so, at this point, hungry for power and domination, that he's just willing to accept the possibility that he might get betrayed in the future.
Right.
I mean, he's still fully on this team. So, okay, well, this person might, you know, turn on me, but you know what, the path I'm on is the one I want, so I'm just going to keep going. I could totally see though also a situation where he's just okay, you know, being subservient to Sauron at some point. If that just means that he still gets to hold on to the power he does carve out.
Yeah.
So I could see it either way. I mean, a lot of the times, I guess the kind of the themes of the wizards is that a lot of them failed their purpose. And I think this is still quintessentially that. Saruman failed his purpose. He was meant to be the leader of the wizards and help guide them. The biggest failure of that purpose is to join the other team. So that's kind of how I see that. And
if I could just add a sort of a comment, sort of the basis of my opinion is, you know, as a Christian, so a lot of my viewpoints on the movie are through that lens, which again, Tolkien may not even have intended. He wasn't necessarily such a fan of the allegory as C.S. Lewis.
He's about to say he's no C.S. Lewis with the hitting you over the head with it. But I mean, it's still there. You can still see it. Guitar, the Maiar. I mean, come on.
Yes. No, exactly.
It's like a mixture of Christian allegory with like World War One allegory.
Yeah.
and you've got it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's even a theory that in between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, there's a tonal change. And the reason for that is because he came back from World War One. Yeah. Right. That's one of the theories of the tonal change there between the novels. And to me, so the basis of mine, again, for my maybe kind of odd take on Saruman is coming from a religious nature where I basically view him as the anti-John the Baptist.
Interesting.
Right. John the Baptist's role was he was to prepare the way for Jesus. And so the famous line in scripture says, John says, I must decrease that he, referring to Christ, must increase. And so to me, that's kind of how I view Saruman, is he's preparing the way for the evil one, and that he must decrease that Saruman may increase. And I argue that in this case, it is, to me, it's so strange where it's, like, how could a selfless evil be worse than a selfish evil? Where you basically have a character who says, it doesn't really matter what happens to me as long as evil is done, versus a character who says, I just like evil. And one is explainable and the other is unexplainable. And to me, it's the unexplainable that makes it more unnerving, in particular with Saruman.
Interesting. Yeah, because once you get to Fellowship, Sauron's kind of just the established evil. You expect that out of him.
Yes.
He just kind of is. And yeah. I get that. I, from what I understand, there is a point in time where he maybe wasn't that. Same with Morgoth, I think, at some point. Then there's a whole other can of worms, which, you know, were they destined to become evil, or was it just all natural? I don't know. But it is an interesting kind of thing to look at when it comes to particularly quote-unquote evil characters.
Yes.
Or antagonists, because, you know, some of them are just like, they're evil because they're evil. It's just who they are at this point.
Yes.
Then there's some who, through circumstance or experience or for whatever reason, they choose it or they fall into it.
Yes.
Or they're corrupted into it as well. And so I think in Sauron's case, it's more of that. And yeah, I guess you get to see more of the dichotomy of, you don't really get to see it, but I guess you're kind of told and not shown in this case, where like, Saruman's the leader of my order. He knows what to do. I'm going to go to him. So he's almost like a father figure to Gandalf in that sense, which is weird.
That's right.
But so I guess you see a bit more of a turn there, which makes it a little more tragic and a little more interesting, I would say. Because you really don't get a sense of Sauron pre-evil.
Correct.
At this point, he's almost just like a force in himself. He's just the embodiment of evil that happens to be here at this time.
Yes.
So I guess that does make it kind of an interesting way to look at it. I'd argue maybe Saruman has a little more depth to him, even though I'd probably argue that neither of these two antagonists are particularly deep. But I guess there's a little more to chew on with Saruman than there is Sauron, at least at this point, with the information that we have in the movie.
Yes.
I'm sure there's a lot of Lord of the Rings lovers out there who are probably yelling at their device right now. But I mean, it's based off the information that I have and on what we've seen in Fellowship of the Ring so far.
Yes. Agreed. No. Yeah. I wanted to say a question I wanted to ask you about is, There's a moment in the extended edition of Fellowship of the Ring when it may not be a scene that was added, but anyway, a scene in the Fellowship of the Ring when the group is in Rivendell and they're at the council. So you have Legolas, you have Boromir, you have Gimli, you have Aragorn, Gandalf, Elrond, the hobbits, all other minor characters and so on. And there's a moment there when for Elrond, he very much discloses that the ring is not something he's going to keep in Rivendell, which was sort of an assumption on some parts of the party that they could just leave the ring in Rivendell and the elves would take care of it or something like that.
Sure.
And then we have the council where Frodo ultimately says, I'll be the ring bearer. And did you notice or did you observe that? Okay, here's my question. I've been thinking about it. I think this is the best way to articulate it. There's a saying along the lines of here it is. The quote is from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. War is young men dying and old men talking. How much of, do you think, Tolkien's experience with war and conflict fueled that scene in The Council of Elrond, where basically you have all the characters who are older, especially Elrond, who's thousands of years old, who are talking, literally, they're yelling over each other, and then Frodo says, I'll do it. How much do you think that scene was fueled by perhaps his wartime experiences, both as a soldier, but also as a bystander, in a sense, during that conflict?
You know, I guess there's no way to know definitively for sure, but I think that is a great point and something that definitely fits into that box.
Yeah,
I could absolutely see that being an inspiration. And, you know, whenever I think about Tolkien's war experience influencing Lord of the Rings, I mean, I think about just the visual grisliness of the fighting and the savagery of it all. I didn't think about the whole, you know, Council of Elrond kind of being a stand-in for the world powers just bickering and arguing and talking a lot. Meanwhile, the younger generation is the one who gets sent off to go fight.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to, you know, and I don't think anyone at the council is under any sort of pretense that this isn't a big deal.
Right.
I don't think they're that detached. But they're also, I mean, eventually some of them do go to the front lines. But at the same time, there is still that kind of split there. You know, there is a, you know, the meat and potatoes of the risk is going to the hobbits.
That's right.
And so, yeah. And yeah, this is just quiet, almost defeated. I'm going to take it, you know. while they continue to kind of argue for a bit, and Gandalf seems to kind of be the only one who kind of recognizes, because even he's yelling at first, but he's kind of the first to recognize that, hey, in that moment of quiet,
yeah,
we have our volunteer.
Yeah.
So that is interesting. And also another thing about the Council of Elrond, I think this is the last point that I wrote down, was kind of an interesting to highlight kind of how each of the different, you know, peoples here are in their own way ill-equipped to confront Sauron and his forces.
Yeah.
And you see bits and pieces as well as they travel. You know, the hobbits, you know, they're just all content with their lives, don't really care about anything outside the Shire, which is fine in and of itself until, you know, death comes marching at your door. And so that's kind of their inability to look beyond their own borders kind of dooms them in a way. Yes. Or theoretically would. Corrupt, very far from the Numenorean noble people.
Correct.
Caught up in their own way, easily corruptible, doing their own thing, power hungry in their own ways. The elves probably, a little too nihilistic, too easy to give up the potential in maybe themselves and others.
Yeah.
Also probably some pride in there as well.
Yeah.
And because they do kind of have an escape route from all of this.
They do.
A lot of them just peace out and just leave it be. The easy route for them. So that kind of leads to their own kind of inability to, it's not going to stay here. We're not going to keep the ring in Rivendell. And just maybe, their own inability to, the dwarves, dwindling in numbers, too kind of obsessed with mining and their own riches. So I think it's just interesting how the council and just kind of the people and the situations that you hear about along the way, you kind of get a sneak peek into how easily Sauron kind of is able to come back.
Yes.
It kind of answers the question like, okay, well, if you have this continent full of all these different people, and they know he's back, well, why don't they just all unite and go get him, like, immediately once they knew he's back? So you kind of see this, I guess, decay, this complacency.
Yes.
And how almost in every corner of the world you go to, there's a reason these people aren't, why they're distracted, why they're not, turning around to this. And I think it's different for, character to character and people to people in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, this is a question for you also. When I was watching, I noticed that one, in some ways, the ring tempts all of them. For the elves, Galadriel is tempted by the ring. For man, obviously, there's Boromir and Aragorn, right? You have basically the two sides of man. Then with the dwarves, not so much. They're not necessarily tempted by it in any sort of capacity. And then for Gandalf, there's sort of a moment, but he's not necessarily tempted. More is he aware of the danger, and so he's more struck by...
He knows enough to avoid that moment of temptation. So yes. He knows what would happen. So yes. He's self-aware enough to know, this is a risk that I don't want to take. So I'm not even going to let you start to talking about giving this thing to me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And by the end of the Fellowship, there's of course, the pivotal scene when Frodo and Sam go off onto the other shore, and then those remaining, Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn. And Legolas says, we got to go after them. And Aragorn says, their journey is their own now. What did you make of that decision by Aragorn and Frodo, essentially? Did that strike you as a decision that seemed to smell of plot advancement? Or did that seem that seemed an appropriate choice for the world that's been established and the characters that we have? And the reason I ask is because you do dungeon mastering through Dungeons and Dragons. And so one thing I believe you've told me is that if you're going to split up a party, it needs to be you want to be very cautious not to. But if you do, it has to be deliberate and it has to have sort of an intentionality. Do you think this was an intentional decision from Tolkien to split the party? Or was this sort of this decision is what the plot demands, as opposed to an authorial decision?
Right. I can kind of see it both ways. On one hand, splitting the group like this allows a wider story to be told.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if you just stick the Fellowship together the whole time, it's narrow.
Yeah.
They're all going to be in the same place. They're all going to be fighting at the same time. There's only so much you can do with that.
Yeah.
And so I think story-wise, it kind of makes sense to split these people up a bit. I mean, unless you really wanted to make a short story, you can make it work where they're all together and they're heroic and they each have their strengths and weaknesses and they cover for each other and they fight to the end.
Yeah.
That's a story. You can work with that. But, you know, in this case, I think I'm going to go against everything, every Dungeon Master's advice here, and that splitting the party was probably beneficial to the story itself in this instance.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yes. And in the other sense, I kind of think maybe there is a little bit of a, risk reward calculation here. On one hand, Aragorn, everybody standing together. Yeah, sure. There's some strength in numbers. There's some strength in having, it's not like they've got cell phones. So there's strength in communication. So, and they're not going to be in the dark as much if they're together. But I think that maybe Aragorn knew that, if they stay together, it paints a larger target on their back.
Yeah.
Especially once you get to the very end, like when they're actually in Mordor, you kind of get the sense of, like nine people tramping through here isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So in a sense, maybe he's just kind of playing with that risk of, hey, we could stay together and protect each other and maybe have our backs a bit more, or we can split up. We can cause some mischief, pursue our own objectives to support the hobbits as they continue on. But, and put less of a target on all of our backs since we're traveling in the group, but it still leaves the hobbits alone.
Yeah.
So I think it's just weighing the risks. And I think he probably just made the decision that he felt was best at the time.
Yeah.
And it worked out. It'd be interesting to see kind of an alternate history series, Lord of the Rings, where what happens if the Fellowship doesn't break up. I watched a video recently on a YouTube channel that I like a lot, where they talk to, they do some what ifs, and one of the what ifs is like, what if Gandalf kept the ring for himself?
Oh yeah.
That different whole story, but to go back to the original point, I can see it from a story construction point of view, where splitting it makes it a deeper, more interesting story.
Yes.
But I also kind of see how, like, okay, I can see the logic perhaps in the characters weighing the risks of splitting up with sticking together.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think it paid off for them in the end, ultimately.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, as much as I said earlier, to kind of go back to what I said at the start, how this movie doesn't fall into the trap of other fantasy movies, which seem to dictate themselves by lowest common denominator tropes, but at the same time, this is the quintessential hero's journey, right? Joseph Campbell talks about, you have the mentor figure, you have the death, quote unquote, of the character, not necessarily literally, but then the kind of their resurrection, their new purpose. Frodo was literally eventually stung by a giant spider, and he's in some sense, his death is when Gollum has fully deceived him, right? I would say over the spider scene, which I don't watch because I don't like spiders, so I close my eyes even when I saw it in the movie theater all those years ago. And so again, and of course, the status quo has changed, right, by the end. And I guess my closing thought and my question for you is, so to me, Fellowship of the Ring is the, in terms of extended edition, it is the worst of the extended editions of the three movies. It very much, the scenes that are added in the extended edition, most of them do not benefit the movie. There are a few that do. Whereas with the Two Towers, to me, is the strongest extended edition. And then there's Return of the King, which has a few scenes which are questionable at best. And then Fellowship at the Bottom, where a lot of the extended scenes are... it was a smart choice to not release that version as the theatrical version.
Right. It's been a long time since I saw the unextended version of any of these movies.
Yeah.
So I don't recall, so I can't really give a great opinion on what that is. But I guess I kind of agree that overall, probably also Fellowship is kind of the weakest one for me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good setup, but it's also very much a setup movie. It's setting up thing. It's setting up Two Towers and Return of the King. So it's a good start, but it's also probably the less thrilling.
Yes.
I don't know. It just feels less established because it's still establishing things.
Yes. So, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I mean, it's still great. Even, like I said, even my least favorite of the Lord of the Rings movies is still a really good movie to me. I mean, I still like it a lot. But I can definitely see how I prefer Two Towers and Return of the King a bit more. Just in general, and probably also just as a, I don't know, I can appreciate the middle and the end better than I can the beginning almost sometimes, I guess.
Yes.
Especially on repeat viewings, because you know what's coming up, you know? And I guess you know what's happening, you know how it ends as well, but I don't know. For some reason, I'm a little more gung-ho by the time I get to Two Towers and Return of the King. But the Fellowship of the Ring is like, okay, yeah, here we go, here we go, all right. So, I mean, it's still good, but I'm like, okay, this is still just set up.
Yes. So my question to you is, as we close to a moment of theorizing and speculation, what is one, and I'll give you two options, and this is to myself too. What scene would you alter, or what scene would you add to the Fellowship of the Ring to enhance its status amongst the three of them? Fellowship, Two Towers, and Return of the King.
Oh, gosh.
I can reply first if you want.
Yeah, you go first.
Okay. To me, I would modify. And the scene that I would modify is, and again, I'm not sure if this is in the regular extended, because like Adam, I only ever watched the extended for the most in years, and over the past several years, I mean. I would modify. And there's a moment in I can't remember the name of it, but there's a moment when the party goes to see Galadriel. I can't remember the name of that part of the Elven Kingdom. And she's talking with the characters, and she's basically she's kind of quote-unquote prophesying, but what she's really doing for the audience is basically saying, things aren't great. There's stuff's going to happen, and this whole fellowship, this whole attempt to destroy the ring might not work. So it's almost like a reset where you have, up until that point, things, of course, haven't been going great because Gandalf, quote unquote, sacrificed himself, though we know he's not dead. And we get a sense that Boromir will make a play for the ring and so on. And so it kind of operates as sort of a reset where Council of Elrond is to me is the status quo of the Fellowship. And then in the wood, we kind of have a resetting of the status quo. And to me, I think you keep it in that capital of the Elven Kingdom. But what you do is, you shift the focus away from Galadriel and Frodo, because they've received a lot of the focus already, in particular Frodo. And to me, you shift the focus to the relationship between Boromir and Aragorn. Because one thing, my biggest complaint, even in the extended edition, is that when Boromir dies and Aragorn comes over to him and Boromir basically says, I would have followed you to the end, my brother, my captain, my king. And it just doesn't, to me, it doesn't feel earned that Boromir, even in that moment prior to death and perhaps the lucidity of a near-death experience, would issue that kind of declaration, which up until that point had been exceedingly opposite of his outward behavioral displays. We knew there was a struggle in him, so it's not like him thinking that is a problem, but their relationship, to me, was something that should have been, at least in the movie version, should have been developed more so that it more went alongside Gandalf and Saruman. Because though Saruman is in through the first two movies, and they only have one scene together, really, that their opposites, their contrasting nature, which you pointed out, their different trajectories, to me, benefits the movie and the themes. Whereas with Aragorn and Boromir, you have them as opposites, right? Just like Gandalf and Saruman. You have Aragorn as sort of peak humanity and Boromir as sort of fallen humanity. And to me, if they could shift the focus in that elven part where the plot takes a, where the plot kind of comes to a halt and the characters are rejuvenating and there's a moment of rest, not only in plot, but in terms of the characters, focusing on that relationship to strengthen and to make that moment when Boromir does die feel all the more earned. Because to me, Aragorn is in the first movie, for what the role he plays, is far too static. We get a sense that his opinion is starting to shift, that he might lean towards going back to Gondor and reclaiming the throne, but he's very much just a good guy who knows Gandalf and is trustworthy. But by the time we get to Return of the King, that's my take.
Yeah, I guess my issues with Fellowship of the Ring are more smaller things throughout rather than just one scene.
Yeah,
I could probably pick bits and pieces, you know, of each scene and be like, ah, okay, we could have picked up the pace here, we could have stretched this moment out here. Now that you mention, I think postponing Boromir's death maybe towards somewhere in the middle of Two Towers would have been huge.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And I don't know if it would have changed much. I mean, I guess the biggest impact of that is that they lose someone so quickly. So it kind of shakes their faith and their mission a bit.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the biggest impact of having Boromir's death there so early. But I guess I kind of agree is that, you know, one might argue like, okay, you know, they're all, you know, people are raised to, you know, hope for the return of the king. But I kind of agree, though, there wasn't a lot of time to really breathe and let him kind of, I don't know, establish that relationship with Aragorn. I guess that would probably be if I had to choose for that one. I don't know as far as the others. I mean, I'm no movie maker, so I'm just trying to think of what it would change in any of them. I don't know. That's a tough one. Mm-hmm. It's also been a while since I've seen 2 and 3, so maybe if we cover 2 and 3 sometime, I'll have a better answer for that.
Yeah, I understand.
I don't know. I guess if overall, I don't know specifically how this would happen, but if there was a way we could somehow make Fellowship of the Ring feel more like a complete story, like they can stand alone.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, have it, maybe even this, how about this? Have the Ringwraiths, which are also said, like when they talk about them, they're like, yeah, these guys are going to pursue you every step of the way.
Yeah.
And they do it for about 3/4 of Fellowship of the Ring. And then, unless like I said, it's been a while since I've seen the movies, and then they kind of just teleport towards the end of Return of the King when they've ditched their horses for the flying animals.
Right. They show up in Two Towers once, but in terms of substantive, yeah, Return of the King.
Sure, and so I mean, I guess my gripe with that though is that, like, they make a big deal about like these riders are going to doggedly pursue you.
You can't kill them.
Yeah, like they're undead. They don't tire. They don't need to stop and eat and drink or rest. They're just trying to get the ring, and that's it.
Yeah.
And they're going to be on you the entire time. And for that first little bit, you feel that. Yes. Like they're in pursuit. And I guess you can't do that the whole time because you have to have other, you know, storylines and beats and enemies to deal with. And it would be a little much if it was like every single frame was them, you know, if it was just them all the time. But I don't know. I feel like we could have done maybe a little more with them.
Agreed.
Throughout both Fellowship of the Ring and, but more particular, probably 2 and 3 in terms of, like they're still, they should still be in pursuit. Like if they're, if these are these powerful nine, people that, that Sauron sends off the bat, he's their first pick. He's their first pick to go get the ring. I don't know. I feel like they could have had a little
more. And the number one pick in the Middle East, the Middle Earth draft
is the Nazgul. Here we go. the ring rates. I don't know. I guess that would change that too, is have them without using them too much, but still have them be a persistent threat, a sense that they're still on your tail. I needed that. Maybe
That's a good point.
And I get it, they pivot and they need to, and it's good and fine and all, especially now that you got the Balrog that kind of takes their place a bit in terms of the big obstacle.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just wish I had like maybe like 10 to 15, maybe 20% more ring wraiths being in pursuit. You don't even have to show them a lot. Just establish that they're still hot on your tail and you can't turn back.
Yeah.
Like that would have been good.
Yes. No, that's a good point. I think within the Fellowship in particular, it would have added some nice story compression, which I think would have helped some of the pacing, because the pacing in Fellowship, the middle portion of Fellowship is the worst paced out of the whole trilogy.
Yeah. Like I said, if you want Fellowship to be a more complete story that stands on its own, have it be a story about how the Fellowship can come together and like get ahead of these pursuers.
Yes.
And have that kind of be the, have the ring race kind of be the bracket to the story there.
Agreed.
And
I think what they could have done with that, I'm just thinking of this, is you have almost like Empire Strikes Back. What you do is you have a Hoth moment where it's the beginning of this, of the two towers, and that's when the separation happens. Sure. Maybe that's when Boromir dies, you know, 20-30 minutes into the movie, and that's when the Fellowship separates.
That'd be great.
I think that would have been a really interesting choice, which obviously is not from the books, but that would have been an interesting cinematic deviation.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, any final thoughts?
Not off the bat. Like I said, I love these movies. I really do. They're fun. They get you pumped, and they're just good stories. You know, like I said at the beginning of this, I'm just hanging on every word here and every action. Yeah. It's just everything feels so good.
Yeah.
And tactile and meaningful. And I don't think there's a wasted line of dialogue. I say that now. I'll probably find something later, but I don't know. At least throughout this viewing, I was just like, wow. I was just speechless a lot, because I was like, gosh, I can just listen to these characters talk for hours.
Agreed.
Like I said, even though it's probably my least favorite of three, still a good movie. Still like it. Classic.
Yes.
Holds up.
And in closing, I'll just say one thing that is one reason why I love these movies so much is, in particular nowadays, where a lot of modern content, particularly movie and TV show, the characters don't feel like they live in the world. They're perfectly manicured, their hair, they don't sweat, they're not grimy. They almost feel like plastic. It feels like almost that they've dumped antiseptic into the actual filming of the scenes. And whereas in this one, apart from the moments where they go someplace and they quote unquote rest and shower, they're always gross. They're always dirty. They're always messy. They're disheveled. They're hunched. They're worn. They're broken at times. And I love that, because especially nowadays where, like I said, everything is as if it's just been coated, even almost the filming of it seems it's been coated in hand sanitizer. Where like even Rings of Power or the other fantasy show Wheel of Time, where one of the big complaints I've seen of that is just it feels like all the characters take a shower after every scene. And in a world where they're in a fantasy world, when you know you live outside, you know, so that's something that strikes that I just love. And it's such a
it feels lived in.
And it's such an intentional choice. Mm-hmm. Like you do that on purpose. And I love that decision because you just don't really see a lot of that anymore. Everyone has to be super attractive all the time.
I did notice that Bilbo did have some sweat on his forehead. I guess it was the downside of having big screen TVs these days, but I was like, there oh, yeah.
That's funny. That was funny. All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us. As the credits roll here on another episode of Friendly Critics, we hope you've enjoyed our lively discussion and gained a fresh perspective on the film Fellowship of the Ring that we've examined. Remember, the conversation doesn't end here. Connect with us on all the different hosting platforms, which is all the big ones and some other subsidiaries, to share your thoughts, recommendations, and perhaps your own critical analysis. Until next time, happy watching.
Bye. Don't hate us if you're a Tolkien fan. We did the best we could.
We tried. See y'all.
Bye.